Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly, Managing Director at AdvisorAnalyst.com, and this is Insight is Capital. We're thrilled to have Saum Saif, the visionary founder and CEO of Purpose Investments, join us. With a passion for innovation and deep understanding of the financial industry, Saum and his crack team at Purpose Investments have been at the forefront of creating investment solutions that truly align with investors' needs. His leadership and forward-thinking approach have made Purpose Investments a standout in the world of finance. We're excited to dive into his thoughts, so stay tuned.
This is the Insight is Capital podcast.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Welcome, Saum. It's great to have you back and catch up with you.
Pierre, it's always great to see you and nice to chat. And, you know, in this kind of crazy, constant changing environment, it's always fun to have a little bit of conversation and step back and maybe think a little bit about what's going on.
Absolutely. So, Saum, markets have been kind of wonky this year. Stocks are at all-time highs. Yields have been volatile. Rates have been volatile. And long bonds have skirted 20-year lows. Stocks are defying gravity, or are they? And at the center of all of this, bonds have been telling a different story. We've got sort of a K-shaped market. What's your take on all that?
Well, I think first and foremost, we went into this year with a certain level of expectations around how the Fed and the, you know, central banks would be acting because of the economic backdrop. And you know, I think it's amazing. You know, last year we entered in 2023, people were very bearish, and the beginning of this year we went into it and people were very bullish. You know, just coming into it, assuming that the economic recessions weren't yet, you know, in reality, and people were sort of pushing off their forecasts of whether or not there was going to be one. As we sort of look at it, I mean, it's sort of been correct to broadly be directionally bullish year to date. However, it's not a all rosy situation. And you look at, to your point, you know, stock market indexes for the most part are up quite nicely. However, if you actually look at what's happening underneath the hood, there's a lot of, you know, kind of noise and specifics. As we've talked a lot about over the last couple of months, the specific names that keep driving the markets from a momentum perspective on the surface are continuing to drive the markets higher. And the broader stock portfolios actually have not necessarily been performing as well as everyone would expect. Second is that bond markets have been very volatile. And we've seen that volatility because, you know, the market has a certain assumption about what the Fed is going to do. As we entered in the year, you know, a lot of the market forecasters believe the Fed was going to be cutting rates very aggressively. And of course, we're now 5 months into the year and the US Fed has not cut rates. Of course, Bank of Canada just cut rates this past week.
Right.
But the and there is a divergence there, which we can get into. But the US Fed is actually looking like it's getting less and less likely to cut rates. And this is a really important point because, you know, when we went into the year, you know, one of the things we talked a lot about to the investors was the consensus was that the Fed was going to be aggressive in cutting rates. I think that that consensus, in our opinion, was wrong. We actually believed that the Fed was going to be less likely to be aggressive on cutting rates. And we wouldn't have been surprised if at the end of this year, the rates, especially on the Fed rates in the US, were going to be flat. And yeah, that would have been a very, in our opinion, actually somewhat negative assumption for our equity markets. You know, we've seen 5 months go forward with constant revisiting of the Fed expectations, you know, moving those the numbers up in terms of what ending rate would be. And the equity markets have moved up regardless. And I think some of that is related to, you know, a good economy that continues to sort of chug along. And two is some of the really exciting and energy around AI that is driving a handful of names, but broadly, you know, giving people a lot of optimism about economic productivity and growth over the next number of years.
Yeah, I mean, when you see, you know, a stock like NVIDIA gain $500 billion in market cap in 3 days, it's hard to both get, I mean, it's hard not to get excited about that. And at the same time, it's kind of scary when you see, you know, what looks like an enormous amount of wealth being created, I mean, which is an enormous amount of wealth being created almost instantaneously on the back of, you know, what were superb earnings for the company, but in relation to the valuation, wild. I mean, that's kind of a wild market that we've got. And then, of course, we've seen the return of speculation, you know, with the meme stocks. And, you know, so there's a lot of speculation fueling equities right now. But when you look over at the bond market, you get a totally different picture. And I want to go back to December, where we had that anticipated, you know, 6 to 8 rate cuts following Powell's, Jay Powell's presser in November. I mean, the market got really ahead of itself there, you know, and I think most investors, frankly, I mean, that was a blip in terms of investors sort of missing out on maybe a duration bet in the bond market.
I think the interesting thing there was, whether or not the market was, forecasting 6 to 8 rate cuts, the thing that,
well, we gave it all back, right? We gave it all back very quickly. And, you know, I recall in early December, one of the heads of fixed income at one of our big banks, was saying that, you know, this is what the market wants to do right now is test 3.5 again on the 10-year U.S. Treasury. But by mid-year, there's a really good chance we'll test 5 again. And you know, like that was such a prescient call to make. And it seemed so outlandish at that time. But I mean, it's exactly what happened, right? I mean, we've, you know, the last 5 months, which is hard to believe again, as we said, you know, in our pre-chat, which is 5 months have gone by in 2024. It's been kind of a blur, and it's been this crazy market. Sorry, and I interrupted you, so go ahead.
As we kind of looked at the beginning of the year, I mean, the forecast of whether Fed was going to cut rates 6 to 8 times, that's a sort of a, call it a consensus assumption that was kind of formed. But, you know, what we always look at is what are the sort of other assumptions? What happens if rates don't go down by that much? Or what if they go up? You know, and,
right,
and how are you positioned in your portfolio against that? Now, the thing that was really troubling at the time was that at the same time, the market had already pre-priced in those 6 to 8 cuts. And the 10-year, the U.S. Treasury was trading around 4%. And in our opinion, you know, the fair value of the U.S. Treasury was probably more, for the 10-year, was probably more like 5, to your point.
Right.
And what we sort of thought a lot about is, okay, well, what if the Fed does cut 6 to 8 times? Well, the market's already priced a fair amount of that in. So you know, if you're buying long duration bonds, you're not going to see a significant gain unless, you know, the Fed signals are going to continue to cut down. And and in that case, you know, you'll generate a little bit of excess because the 10-year will go down even further. But what if you're wrong? What if the Fed isn't going to be as aggressive? What if you're wrong? And what I care about in any asset that we buy, in any asset that we think about, is, you know, yes, in the long run, what is the long-term assumption of economic or market or earnings or whatever it be? But what is the price of the stock relative to that? Or what is the price of the asset relative to that? And when you see a 4% 10-year treasury, what it was basically saying was price to perfection.
You're right.
And that's where I think a lot of people miss cue on these things, because getting an assumption of what the, you know, economists or the Fed or central banks or the earnings of a company are going to do is one thing, but you have to also look that in association with where the market is pricing that today. So that's the first. I will step back and say, a large part of this period is because, and this is something I've talked about for a decade, is that we, unfortunately, as an industry, have very few people who have perspective. And I say that in the kindest way possible.
Right.
What I mean by that is that 98% of our industry has grown up in the last 44, 45 years of experience. And what does that mean? They don't have a tenure of their career that goes beyond 1980.
Right.
When they think about rising rates, they think about periods in the past where rates have gone up for 12 months, 18 months, and then precipitously come back down. And none of them have really seen, or, I mean, even though you can look at back history data and all the rest of it, and everyone now talks about inflationary periods and all the rest of it, none of them have really seen a period where rates actually stay high and potentially go higher. And that is not a part of most people's mental models.
No.
This has been something that I think has been hurting our industry, because if you look at the last 3 years, if you look at the market's assumption since 2022 about what the Fed would do with interest rates, it has continuously been a slope downwards, forward slope downwards. And if you look at it month over month over month over month, that slope has continually gone flat or up. And in fact, what people have realized is that their assumptions have been always to go back down, and it's been wrong.
Right.
And so I think that's largely because of people articulating what they know, not thinking in first principles about the situation and what's going on. And so that's how we always like to look at it. And I think that's what is causing the market to be what it is. Now, the 10-year is still at 4.4%. You know, it as you say, it's ranged from 4 to 4.8 or so thereabouts, and it's at 4.4 today. And, you know, maybe that's more like a fair value. I don't know. But it's still making
closer.
A pretty large mm-hmm. assumption about what the Fed's actions are going to be. And it prices in very little risk on what is the inflationary trend over the next 12 to 24 to 36 months. It prices very little impact of, you know, what if the robustness of the economy continues to be strong and the Fed is not in a rush to cut rates faster.
Well, that's just it, right? I mean, we've got this resilient U.S. consumer, and, you know, part of it is that, you know, we've had a lot of interesting conversations here over the last year. And, you know, part of it is that, you know, the U.S. consumer is locked into some very long mortgages, right? And they, you know, they're, you know, one of the problems in the housing market benefits in the housing market right now, which has made U.S. consumers more resilient and therefore the economy more resilient, is the fact that you know, many mortgagees locked in, you know, mortgages with two handles and three handles, you know, a couple of years ago. Not all of them, but many, you know, I think something in the order of 67 or 70%. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but in any event, I mean, the U.S., compared to Canada, the U.S. consumer is a lot more resilient. On top of that, on top of having locked in low mortgage rates, their mortgage interest is tax deductible. So they have even more disposable income as a result. You know, at tax time, they have way more disposable income than we do, way more resources on hand than we do, relative to the fact that we don't get to write off our mortgage interest in Canada. But there's some cracks starting to show in the U.S. economy. I mean, if you go beyond, obviously, the home ownership market and owner equivalent rents, I mean, today there was a big story in Bloomberg about the failure of apartment buildings and, you know, because of speculation. And so we're starting to see some weakness start to creep in and into the U.S. economy. And that's probably a lagging effect of the, you know, rate hikes that we saw in the last 2 years. But it's a very slow turning ship, right? It takes a really long time. It's taking a lot longer than people thought it would for the U.S. I think it happened a lot sooner for Canada, which precipitated the rate cut this month, finally, from Tiff Macklem a few days ago. But when you compare rate volatility to the VIX, for example, if we're just coming back to markets now, the VIX is around 13 or 14. And the, you know, volatility of rates as measured by the MOVE index has been substantially higher, like a multiple higher than that. And so it signals a lot of uncertainty in the, from the bond market side versus what's going on in equities. So we've got this, it's a very strange, very uncertain market. Some have even suggested that the stock rally and the speculation that we're seeing is this last big blow off, but it's not a risk on trade, which it definitely looks like a risk on trade, but it's more of a knee jerk reaction to risk aversion, where, you know, investors figure, oh, you know, these stocks are, you know, because of the hindsight, the recency bias of 2023, you know, AI stocks seem to be like endlessly powerful, but it's hard not to help feeling like something incipient is around the corner, some incipient, you know, event. And there's so many moving parts this year, being an election year. There's a lot of geopolitical stuff going on globally. I mean, when you look at the big picture, Sam, what are you optimistic about?
Well, there's a lot of what you just talked about. Let me unpack a few things.
Yeah.
So look, the VIX is not a great indicator right now of what actually the market's volatility is. And so the VIX is actually being artificially held down by a substantial increase in 0-day options and more call writing funds that are out there. And so this has been a big area of investment. People that are yield hungry have been buying option writing strategies to generate greater income. It's become a big part of the US market, things like that. And then 0-day options, you know, which generally means retail investors, have exploded in terms of volume. And those are actually driving down what I'd call, and just so everyone is familiar, the VIX is the S&P 500 index.
Right.
And VIX is an index volatility measure. And the move is the bond market volatility. And so it doesn't have those same factors, but the other factors are really driving down the VIX. Now, if you look at individual stock volatility, actually those options and those volatilities are actually much higher. And so I actually do think the volatility is in the market. It's being somewhat artificially held back and on the surface, but underneath it, it is a volatile market environment. And you see that when companies come out with certain earnings, you're seeing a much greater dispersion between, you know, what the expectations are and the market price reaction, both up and down. And that is actually impacting, you know, single stock risk. I think the question on, so does the bond market signal something? I think the bond market's actually probably pricing in volatility effectively, and the VIX is not, but the
right.
stock market individual stocks is probably higher. It is so, actually pricing them.
So at some point, I mean, something is going to have to give between that gap.
Well,
that yes, divergence, right?
No. Remember, it's what's the average or what's the sort of thing that's happening on the surface on S&P 500 index vol versus the average of single stock vol. I think that's probably a better measure.
Right.
I think what's got to give is it sustainable to have, you know, option writing the way it is, to have retail, what happens when retail, doesn't get as aggressive. Like we've seen cycles where retail comes and goes and they're, you know, bullish and not bullish. And so some of that will have some influence on the markets, no question. And, you know, some of it could also be related to like if the Magnificent Seven, who has big expectations, if some of them don't meet their expectations, then all of a sudden you could see some of that get hurt and it just spirals from there. I think the bigger thing around what's happening right now with expectations and markets, and no question, there are small trends, credit cards and, defaults and credit, loan defaults and just, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that are slightly angling up and moving forward. But I would say that for the most part, they're still relatively, you know, good. I mean, there's nothing right. that's signaling red. And so for that reason, I don't think the economy is suggesting, especially in the United States, I'd say, that there's trouble abound. I mean, what I always look at today, you know, the Fed, they announced payrolls and it was a big number, very positive number, much bigger than expectations.
Right.
And what we always have to remember is if people are employed, they're going to spend. And it's only when you start to see real impact on unemployment rates, that's when you would probably look at, you know, the potential, you know, depth of a recession or some consumer spending slowdown, things like that. We're definitely not seeing it on the earnings side. Like retailers and retail companies or consumption-based businesses continue to, you know, provide really strong earnings and revenue growth and all the rest of it. And so, I mean, it's always hit and miss in terms of what the quality of the business is, but for the most part, you know, we're seeing really strong results out there.
Right.
And so I think that people have underestimated the resilience of the economy. They've done that for the last 18 months. And I think the there's nothing right now that's signaling that we're going to see a deep recession. We might see a mild recession. We may have already seen one in Canada, theoretically, and I think that's what the Bank of Canada may be signaling. But I don't think that, you know, we've seen it in the United States yet. And it's really now a question of, you know, is it a mild recession or is it even a recession at all, or just a slight growth relative to expectations? But beyond that, I think that's actually quite robust for the equity markets.
But what if it's a bifurcation where the strong part of the economy holds up the weakest parts of the economy, which is something that happens obviously on an ongoing basis anyway? You're always going to have strong elements of the economy holding up the weak elements of the economy. But, you know, with all the activity in the equity market, the strength of the investor class versus the weakness in the non-investor class, is it possible that the weak parts of the economy could get substantially weaker while the strong parts of the economy continue to get stronger? Like, how sustainable is this market trend where, you know, like, for example, like we've had this expectation that weak economic data will lead to lower bond yields. That's part of this paradigm, this old paradigm that you were just explaining a moment ago. Without that historical perspective, like there's a lot of analogs in the longer history of our economies and markets where, you know, you look at the World War II analog or the 70s, the 1970s analog. And I'm not suggesting by that's what we're looking at is some kind of, you know, rhyming, but it's possible, right? I mean, there's aspects, like if you go beyond, you know, 1980 into the past, you know, there's been some pretty rough spots where higher rates for longer really had an impact, not to mention the fact that, you know, inflationary periods or periods of higher rates for longer have also led to correlations between stocks and bonds rising.
Yeah. I mean, first off, Pierre, so, I think that the divergence between rich and poor and, you know, good economy, bad economy, growth versus non-growth, secular declines, that is always happening in the market.
Right.
You know, there's no question the trend towards, you know, I mean, the rich, you know, and the wealth, the concentration, all those things have been going on for a long time, really in the last 40, 50 years, we've seen a significant shift towards that. And that is something that has to be addressed. But frankly, the markets, that's not really a market driving item in my
right. opinion. But it is a driver of the economy. I mean, it is.
Yeah, no,
but they're not one and the same, obviously.
But the thing is, it's constantly it's out there and it's happening. But generally, what you care about is, you know, is consumption on a broad basis, you know, attractive and strong? Yes, there will be losers, and there will be losing parts of the economy, and there'll be, you know, and people have to be mindful of that. Like, you are seeing, a difference, a widening behavior between higher end consumers and lower end consumers right now, and that is definitely affecting certain types of companies differently than others, right? And so I think that stuff is always happening. And I don't mean to reduce it. I it's something that we care deeply and passionately about, but mm-hmm. I don't think that that's something that should be a factor in whether or not the stock market's going to be affected. It's the market is going to care about our businesses winning broadly. There are definitely segments of the economy that are, you know, in difficult time. I mean, real estate, we know it, is going to continue to be a very challenging place for investors and for owners. It is going to continue to be a problem, and it's going to be for a long time because the world is changing. Interest rates alone is one impact, but just, you know, the demand side of the function is changing. So people just have to be aware of these things, and that's happening. I'd say that.
So what factors do you think would disrupt the current dynamic?
And what do you mean by that in terms of what factors?
Like, so, I mean, housing will continue to be something that people will have to get used to being a challenge.
But you said it earlier, it's the U.S. is a different market than Canada. Canada has a, you know, cost of capital and also a supply and demand issue, like broadly. And, you know, that has a real impact on, you know, call it the movement of assets and such. And we have a supply problem still, and that's having a price issue. Otherwise, if you didn't have the supply problem, you know, prices would likely be down quite materially because of the cost of capital going up. I mean, just simple as that. But if without further supply, you know, it's become a real challenge. The U.S. is very different because, you know, in the United States, you've got, as you put it, probably a disincentive for turnover. And
right.
So new home building is, you know, of course one thing, but, you know, the existing home turnover is very low because people who have a low cost mortgage are, you know, really disincented, to move.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
And to change homes and to turn over like they were, you know, when rates were so low and you could basically get, you continue to refinance. So I think there's those types of, they're very different factors. And you know, so I think the Canadian economy does have the impact of, you know, this like where most people's home is their value of their retirement or their asset. It is a big issue. And, but, you know, in the absence of further supply, we're going to continue to see pricing pressure because, you know, people have to put a roof over their head. Right. So, I mean, one of the things that are going to correct this, if we continue to see,
at the heart of this is employment. As long as employment is strong, the consumer is strong.
My thinking, and I've always said this, is if people have a job, they pay their mortgages,
they pay
their debts, they buy their groceries and their non-discretionary items. The question is, do they have excess to be able to continue to spend on non-discretionary items? And we have not seen really much to suggest that people are not spending on travel, on the luxury elements, you know, and so those continue to kind of, you know, do quite well. And maybe some of that is being driven by a certain speed of the economy, a certain speed of segment of the economy, but broadly they are still attractive in terms of, you know, dollar spend. I mean, you know, planes are full, cars are getting bought. You know, demand at the lots is very high in terms of the dealerships. It's nothing is showing the cracks yet, but you know, you're watching for these things and you want to see that in the earnings. You want to see that in the way that the companies talk about it. And you want to see that through just the data and the economic activity data.
Yeah. So as long as the Fed is worried about employment being so strong, to your point, going back, you know, this expectation that the Fed is going to cut has eroded, right? I mean, it's completely, it looks like it evaporated. And, you know, watching, you know, Fed presidents roll out their statements, you know, beyond Jay Powell and, you know, eventually coming down to Neil Kashkari, who turned around and said there might not be any rate cuts this year. You know, I think that was about a month or a month and a half ago. If you look at that, I mean, even while the Fed and the committee have basically rolled back and improved their optionality in terms of what they can do, you know, what they will actually do in the course of the year. You know, at what point do investors, is there a possibility other than, you know, seeing weak employment numbers, is there some possibility that something else or, you know, will cause a reaction in investors to think, you know, if rates are, you know, when does the realization come in that rates might be higher for a lot longer than anybody realized? You know, when do people actually start to say, like, when something's got to give, you know, or it's not getting any better, or prices aren't falling, you know, like we're not seeing obviously any deflation. It's just the rate of inflation is slowing down. The second derivative, the growth of inflation, there really isn't a lot of relief, in sight. And yet the stock market, the equity market keeps on going on the strength of.
Pierre, the real question is how should we balance and how should we invest in a portfolio given the uncertainty of direction?
Right.
And that's what, again, I go back to is like, I can sit here and try to tell you why I think the, you know, rates are going to go up or down or whatever. I'm as right as probably, you know, the next guy or wrong as the next guy. And who knows, I'm, you know, what the probability of that is.
All right.
Let me finish.
Yeah.
What I was going to say was, what people need to do is look at all of the different scenarios and ensure that they understand if rates go down, what does it mean? How am I positioned? If rates stay flat, how am I positioned?
Right.
If rates go up, how am I positioned? And what probabilities would I, you know, apply to each of those? It isn't an average of those. It's a, you break yourself down into the scenarios, and then you make sure your portfolio is positioned for what you think are the realistic higher probabilities and even potentially for the very low, probably remote situation, but that maybe you have a small sliver of protection against that or a part of your portfolio that benefits from those types of things. And so it's not a fruitful exercise for advisors to go and try to spend their time trying to make a very strong call and tilt their entire portfolio or their position
right
to one eventuality. Because we don't know. And you know, when momentum is strong, yes, you can do those things and you can play that game. But when you have uncertainty, and as you've seen in volatility and all the rest of it, you know, the bond market is telling you that it is uncertain. And so therefore, advisors should be assuming uncertainty and then let data change their mind. And data is ultimately the thing that's going to, but position themselves today to that situation of multiple outcomes. And then let the data basically make them have more consensus or more conviction to the actual place where they go a little bit more aggressive in one direction or not. So I don't believe you should be trying to forecast the exact direction. You should forecast the different scenarios. And that's how every portfolio should be built.
I agree. And to your point, my question to you is what proportion, I mean, from your intelligence that you gather, what proportion of advisors is building portfolios, are building portfolios that take into account that all-weather type thinking where, you know, if the Fed cuts, what do I do? If the Fed stays put, what do I do? If the Fed raises rates, what do I do? You know, what proportion of advisors and investors, for that matter, are positioned that way?
The sophistication of the tools that advisors can use today, they have a lot of inputs, like a lot of people telling them what they think. The question is, do they have all the sophistication to be able to analyze them? And that's a harder thing to do in a fragmented way across thousands of advisors and all the rest of it. However, there's better and better tools and there's better modeling stuff that's available. But the bigger thing is that most advisors actually rely on managed money to support them in this type of thing. So they might...
Right.
You know, have an allocation in their fixed income book to active fixed income with the assumption that the active money manager is making that kind of decisioning. Or they might have three different managers who have three different angles of how to play the markets. And that might be their approach. And so they're diversifying through manager diversity versus just a high conviction, you know, single manager. And so I think there's a bunch of ways that advisors do it. But I think that there is, you know, a level of sophistication that could always be brought into this. But what really matters is the, you know, the investor, the advisor to be stopping and thinking this way first and saying, what are my different assumptions about the outcome? And then making sure that I have the right alignment, whether I'm using managed money or if I'm using my own selection or my own portfolio selection and indexing and all the rest of it, that I am actually balancing that and I have the tools to do so. And look, I think that everyone would love to say that that's what they're positioning. It's a question of if everyone is doing it. I think it's more being articulated through managed money partnerships. I also say that, like, you know, as we build more, you know, traditional like PM-based ETF portfolios, this is actually something that really comes down to the right tools. You know, what kind of access points, what kind of products are out there that give you those different, call it, ways to hedge or participate in different outcomes in the market. And that's a really important thing on product, you know, the products that are available in the marketplace for people to be able to utilize.
And would you say that advisors are actively consulting your team on what to do with their model portfolios
Yeah. I mean, this is probably one of the biggest areas of growth in our business. We have a partners program where we support advisors in kind of like an outsourced CIO on these types of things across their portfolios. And I think it's actually a really important thing because it's, we don't come in and tell them what they should do. We come in and kind of, you know, be a partner to help them think about what they're doing, a debate, discuss. And then really we tell them how we're thinking about it and they think about how they're doing it. And then we share ideas together. And so I think, you know, absolutely. I think it's a really powerful thing. And we see a lot of advisors looking for partners in portfolio construction, as opposed to just, you know, someone just telling them what to do. They want someone who helps them think about the way that they're analyzing their portfolio construction and also kind of getting other ideas that they may be missing.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. I'm asking you because I feel like a lot of advisors might not be making the most of those resources that you have available to them, and they can turn to you for that expertise so that they're not operating in a vacuum.
Yeah, it's a powerful look. These are services that I think are really critical at a time like this. What I always find amazing is, you know, many advisors, I go into an office and you know, there'll be 30 advisors in an office, but they don't talk to each other. They run their own practice. And I always say, like, if I'm in a room with people who have the same problems, same, you know, challenges with their customers with how to position them in markets, you know, everything like tax, planning, all the rest of it. To me, I would be building my advisor group and partners and debating. And just like, you know, my PMs and my portfolio management team, you know, they all manage their own different elements, but they have their own assumptions, but they come together and they share ideas and they debate. And one person may think that interest rates are going up. Another person has a thesis on why interest rates are going to stay flat. And they debate that so that they actually inform each other. It doesn't mean that they have to go back and implement the same strategy, but they have to be informed on the other person's opinion. And so I think it's a really powerful thing. And, you know, I think that advisors are always looking for counsel and partners to debate and discuss and share ideas, especially when you have, you know, you're dealing with the same problems in one business versus another business. And so it's a question of how do you share those ideas and then learn from each other.
Yeah. I mean, and to your point, I think, you know, it's not that advisors, you know, you definitely don't want to, it's a very egotistical business, right? But you know, you don't want to tell advisors what to do, but when they ask you, you know, what should I do, or what, you know, what's your vision of the future? You know, how do things unfold here, and you know, what's the best course of action? It's wonderful to know that you know they have the ability to turn to you. Are there any indicators or signals investors should watch for, or advisors should watch for, to anticipate changes in market volatility? I mean, to your point, getting your portfolio set up for all the scenarios that could play out. What's a good place for advisors to start if they haven't yet?
The benefit that you know, we have in this industry is there's a lot of people who have lots of opinions.
Endless.
There's a lot of people who like to project their what they think is going to happen. The forecasting, the different approaches through modeling, like, do I use quants? Do I use qualitative? Do I use historical signals? Do I use momentum trends? Do I use there's a bunch of people. And then there's a whole bunch of economic forecasters and all the rest of it. It's really, in my opinion, that's actually a really good thing because, you know, you want to basically capture all that. One of the things I learned a long time ago, I was a banker at RBC for, you know, my early years, and I went through the tech bubble. And, you know, I used to watch and listen to, and this was back in the days when, you know, research analysts would do, you know, would actually be much more embedded in processes of the investment.
Right.
And, you know, of course, they had to post that. They separated all that. But, you know, I used to sort of watch it and I'd say, like, wow, like, this is offside. But what it basically taught me was research analysts have really good research. They get in depth on stocks or on markets or on problems, you know, things that they're basically trying to really research deeply. I don't think that their outcome of the actual target, like, hey, buy this stock because it's going to go this, or sell this, or, you know, position there, is actually correct. But the research is very good. So what I always say to people is, you know, read the research. Don't look at the recommendation.
Right.
Read the research and then make your own decision on how, if that research comes true, what would it mean? And that's the way to basically best do it. And an advisor who's looking for that, there's a lot of content out there to do it with. There's also a lot of support. You know, bring people, whether it's at the home office or if it's, you know, through partnerships like what we do and things like that, but bring people to come in and, you know, challenge you and give you different perspectives, show how they're looking at it. And then you can kind of debate it. And maybe some, maybe 30% of what you do is overlapped and 30% is, 70% is, you know, kind of challenged. And you have to basically now figure out, you know, what side do I believe in and not believe in? And then maybe I want to position to some of the potential risks that they're thinking about versus the things I'm thinking about. So that's all it comes down to. And it, I think it starts. And, you know, my view is every advisor should be using the content that they're provided constantly and then making their own decision based on that content versus listening to the recommendations.
Yeah. I mean, those are our thoughts exactly too, which is, you know, read as much as you can, investigate your options as much as you can, and then make your own decisions. And, you know, we that's what we've been trying to do for 15 years is, you know, provide advisors with, you know, a multitude of sources of opinion and intelligence and make the most of that and, you know, put it all together, connect the dots. My closing question for you is, what's the best advice you've ever heard or received?
Oh,
not necessarily with investing, but just universally.
Well, I mean, that's a loaded question as well. Advice that I've given, you know, I've not had any one person give me lots of advice. I've had lots of people give me advice, and I'm a sponge for, you know, what makes other people successful in both, you know, personal and career. You know, I think one of my favorite pieces of advice that I learned early, just from a, you know, call it telling your story, was my first business. I started Claymore. I partnered early on with a really phenomenal individual named Rob Arnott, and Rob was the founder of Research Affiliate,
right,
which we, you know, created the RAFI indexes. And, you know, we were the first in the world to launch RAFI based product. And Rob, you know, and I got to know each other very well. It's a beautiful story, you know, of us just you know, getting to know one another early and a research idea. And then, you know, me kind of having a lot of conviction towards it. But I remember, so I had Rob come up to Toronto, Fairmount, or come across Canada for marketing. And this was, you know, 2005, 2006, back when, you know, people thought ETFs were EFTs, or, you know, it was just a funny time. But one of the things, you know, I remember we did our first roadshow meetings, and I had Rob go and talk about the fundamental indexes and the importance of them. And he had a beautiful presentation that he did. And then, you know, a couple of months later, I had Rob back up and we had a, you know, we did another roadshow. And I remember, you know, we went back and we had a lot of the same people in the same room. There's a large, event hall. And, you know, I remember Rob presenting again, and he presented the exact same presentation. And I kind of was, I was a little squirmy and came out of it, and you know, Rob finished, and I said to Rob, I said, "Oh, Rob, like, that was great, but just so you know, like, a lot of these people were in the room, and they've heard the story again, so you might have, you know, really focused on what's new." And he said, "No, Hassan, you assume that all these people heard me the first time. They listened,
right?
They went on to the rest of their lives, and they moved on. And in this, you know, meeting." You know, my job is to tell them the story, the same story, and say it again, say it again, say it again, say it again, say it again. Why? Yeah. Because every single time they say it, they just becomes, oh, okay. And they're all learning it for the first time again. And at some point it becomes reality. So the best advice, and I learned from that really well, and I was just watching Rob, and he taught me a lot about how to tell your story. And you know, that was early in my career in building my business. And what I will say is that, just a reminder for everyone, when you have something to say, don't assume that you have to keep changing it and saying it in a different way because the other person may have heard it. Say the same thing once, say it again, and keep saying,
right,
saying consistently what are the key things that you want others to know about you or what you're doing, because they're hearing it every single time, and it's just a little bit more and getting embedded into them and ingrained into them. And so, you know, your job is to keep telling the same thing, and their job is to ultimately, hopefully, learn and listen to that. So it's a beautiful advice, and something that I kind of continue to push my team on and everybody around me on. It's just like, when you have something to say, say it 100 times, say it 1,000 times.
Right.
Don't change what you're saying because you think that they've heard it before.
Well, I think, you know, I think that's one thing I think people probably know about you is that you've been very consistent in your message since you started. And so that was advice well taken, and it's advice well given. I think advisors can take something, you know, can take a page out of that book as well, because, you know, you're always trying to improve. And sometimes when you make improvements, they're not necessarily improvements to your story. They're just interfering, right?
But every advisor, every individual, anyone who's got a business, and every advisor has a business, that they're all entrepreneurs. They've got to tell their value proposition, especially in financial services. Like,
yeah,
this is a fragmented business, and there's no winner take all. It's about expressing what you represent, what your values are, why a client who works with you, what they should expect. And say that every single time you meet, every single time you talk to them, every single time, you know, that there's a communication. I remember one of my favorite messages, you know, every single time you send a communication or have a communication to a client, it's an opportunity to market what you are and what you represent. And I think that's a really important reminder as well. But every advisor, like, you know, what I find is sometimes everyone's talking about and changing their tune and changing this, but like, what's your 3 or 4 most important things that every single time you need every customer to know? You say it when they walk in the room, you say it on the way out, you say it in every phone call, and you keep reminding them, because that's what, and you bring everything you do back to those 3 or 4 things.
Fantastic. Saum, thank you as always for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. It's been great to catch up with you. That was fun.
Likewise, Pierre, and great to see you, and thanks for doing this.
Thank you.